Penguin Random House Audio presents How Minds Change, The Surprising Science of Belief, Opinion, and Persuasion. This is the author, David McRaney. In memory of Blake Parker, thank you for giving an only child a brother, always leaving me with new stories to tell, and teaching me how to play hooky with the universe. Introduction. We are about to go on a journey together to understand how minds change. By the end of this journey, you will not only be able to use what we learn to change the minds of others, you will also change your own. I hope, because that's what happened to me, in more ways than one. After writing two books about cognitive biases and logical fallacies, and then spending several years hosting a podcast about those topics, I had settled into a long and comfy pessimism that you may currently share. On stage, behind a microphone, in articles, I often said there was no point in trying to change people's minds about topics like politics, superstitions, or conspiracy theories, and especially not a combination of the three. After all, when was the last time you tried to change someone's mind? How did it go? Thanks to the internet, we have more access to people on the other side of the issues we care about than ever before, so the odds are pretty good you've recently been in an argument with someone who saw things differently. And I bet they didn't change their mind when you presented them with what, to you, seemed like clear evidence of their wrongness. They likely left that argument not only angry, but more convinced than ever they were right and you were wrong. Growing up in Mississippi, like many in my generation, these kinds of arguments were part of our daily lives long before the internet introduced us to the wider world of disagreement. The people in movies and television shows seemed to routinely disagree with the adults who told us the South would rise again, homosexuality was a sin, and evolution was just a theory. Our families seemed stuck in another era. Whether the issue was a scientific fact, a social norm, or a political stance, the things that seemed obviously true to my friends, the ideas reaching us from far away, created a friction in our home lives and on the holidays that most of us learned to avoid. There was no point in trying to change some people's minds. Our cynicism wasn't abstract. In the Bible Belt, there were real stakes to breaking taboos, and from time to time, we each had to make a choice about how and when we'd defy them. As a teenager, I spent a summer delivering flowers for my uncle, who had bought a florist shop in the middle of our small town with money he had saved working as a paramedic. When the landlord began to bully him, my uncle called my father for help. As he hung up the phone, my dad grabbed his car keys and asked me to join him, and then we raced to the shop. He parked, walked into the middle of the confrontation, made it clear there would be trouble if the intimidation continued, and returned to the car. But the thing that stuck with me was that he said nothing on the ride back, nothing the rest of the day, and never mentioned it to the rest of the family. He didn't need to ask for my silence. I knew when we had to keep it a secret. And I did. A science and science fiction nerd, my cynicism only grew stronger after I left home and began working for local newspapers and then local television, just as social media entered our lives. Before becoming a science journalist, one of my responsibilities was moderating the Facebook page for the small news operation at WDAM-TV in Ellisville, Mississippi. For years, I spent a portion of every day reading the disheartening comments of angry viewers threatening to boycott the station after any science story that challenged their worldviews. I realized just how far our viewers were willing to take these arguments when a meteorologist explained on air why climate change was real and most likely the result of carbon emissions from human activity. The comments overflowed with rage after I used the station's official Facebook account to share links from experts. Like most people, I thought the facts would speak for themselves, but a slew of angry commenters countered my links with links of their own, and I spent the afternoon playing fact-check whack-a-mole. The next day, a man confronted one of our news crews out on assignment and asked who ran our Facebook page. They gave him my name, and then he drove to the station and asked to see me in person. Sensing he was potentially dangerous, the receptionist called the sheriff. The angry viewer drove away before police arrived, and local law enforcement added the station's parking lot to their patrols for the rest of the week. but I spent months looking over my shoulder when entering and leaving the building. While still at the station, curious about the psychology behind all this, I started a blog about it. That led to a few books, then lectures around the world, and a new career. I launched a podcast to explore all the ways that people refuse to accept evidence or empathize with others, and under the brand You Are Not So Smart, I made the psychology of motivated reasoning my beat as a science journalist. I was making a decent living telling people that there was no point in trying to change people's minds. But I was never comfortable with that pessimistic viewpoint, especially after witnessing the sudden shift in opinion about same-sex marriage across the United States. That shift that eventually reached my hometown, allowing my uncle to live as an openly gay man and my LGBTQ friends to post photos of their weddings. Though in 2012 the majority of the country was opposed to legalizing same-sex marriage, the very next year the majority supported it. Around 2010, opposition began to plummet. When the majority opinion flipped, the arguments evaporated. Just a few years earlier, I had been moderating daily arguments about how same-sex marriage would ruin America by destroying its family values. Clearly, I thought, people can change their minds, and quickly. So what was the point of all that arguing in the first place? I looked for a scientist who could help me answer a question I had never really considered asking, one that was now making my brain itch. Why do we argue? What purpose does it serve? Is all this bickering online helping or hurting us? I invited the famed cognitive scientist Hugo Mercier, an expert on human reasoning and argumentation, to be a guest on my show. He explained that we evolved to reach consensus, sometimes on the facts, sometimes on right and wrong, sometimes on what to eat for dinner, by banging our heads together. Groups that did a better job of reaching consensus, by both producing and evaluating arguments, were better at reaching communal goals and outsurvived those that didn't. That led to the innate psychology that compels us to persuade others to see things our way when we believe our groups are misguided. Mercier told me that if we couldn't change our minds or the minds of others, there would be no point in arguing in the first place. He asked me to imagine a world where everyone was deaf. People would stop talking, he said. The fact that we so often disagree isn't a bug in human reasoning, it's a feature. For examples of how arguing had led to sudden shifts, all I had to do was look at the history of change in America. I found a book about public opinion by political scientists Benjamin Page and Robert Shapiro that revealed since polling began in the early 20th century, nearly half of the significant opinion shifts in the United States had been, as in the case of same-sex marriage, abrupt. Opinions about abortion, the war in Vietnam, attitudes about race and women and voting rights and smoking and marijuana and many others were stable for years. In each case, arguing had spread from small groups to large, from homes to the House of Representatives. Then all at once, it seemed, that stasis shattered. When the tide of public opinion turned on these issues, it shifted so quickly that if people could step into a time machine and go back just a few years, many would likely argue with themselves with the same fervor they argue about wedge issues today. I started to see the push and pull of our incessant arguing as a form of punctuated equilibrium. That's what they call it in biology. When creatures have the capacity to change, but there's little encouragement to do so, they remain mostly the same from one generation to the next. But when the pressure to adapt increases, the pace of evolution increases in response. Over long timescales, a pattern emerges. Long stretches of sameness, punctuated by periods of rapid change. Looking at the history of social change, revolution, and innovation, it seemed like the same pattern, and I wanted to understand the psychology behind it. I wondered what was happening inside all those brains before and after they changed their minds. What persuades us, and how? What breaks through resistance so powerfully that we not only see things completely differently, but wonder how we saw it any other way? How does a person, over the course of a decade, go from being opposed to the so-called gay agenda to happily attending a same-sex wedding? How does an entire nation go from smoking on airplanes and in offices to banning smoking in bars and restaurants and daytime television? What makes hemlines go up and down, and beards appear and disappear? How did marijuana go from a prescription?
Sample complete. Ready to continue?